Mr. Carr, please resume. Thank you.
Yeah, I have two more minutes on this issue before we move to the statutory issue.
Yes. Okay. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Justice Wainer Abner, in response to your honor's question about if there is another case where money is accepted and then the appeal is filed, I did confirm it is that Stubbe, I can't pronounce the name. It's, I'm sorry, it's Guarantee Insurance Company, that case. At page, at the decision at page 609. Quote, initially, we reject Guarantee's contention that the defendants, having executed upon and obtained satisfaction of the judgment in the amount of $11,248.80, is estopped from pursuing this appeal, implying that the acceptance would then block the appeal. And so that is a case that answers Your Honor's question in that regard. I just want to come back to the very practicality of this, and I thank Chief Justice for giving me the time. In this situation, the judgment's paid. The check is essentially cashed, albeit in our trust account. The court rules do not require me to announce or not cash the check. The warrant to satisfy rule is a record-keeping rule only. It's not a case ending or this case is settled rule, and it does not cross reference any other rules, appellant or otherwise. So as a practical effect, according to the rule that defense is espousing here is before I cash that check, although the rule doesn't require it, the rule requires me 45 days, I have to announce, hey, I might be appealing stuff. Is that in the best interest of my client at that situation? I'm supposed to represent my client zealously. The rules don't require me to make this announcement. The case law doesn't require me to make this announcement. And I'm announcing it. And now they're saying, and then it's going to be, okay, so then we're going to appeal everything too.
Is it your contention that the defendant would then say you're not getting a check yet?
That's up to the defense. And I think that's an excellent question, Justice Patterson, because there was nothing compelling them to pay that. They know the court rules and that the parties have 45 days to file a notice of appeal.
But they had a judgment against them and they paid it. So there is something compelling them to pay it. And that is there's a judgment against them. Obviously, they could have done it later, I suppose. But
45 days of interest when the interest rates were less than 1%, the total maybe 2% of the court rules is negligible. It's 45 days of interest. That's all they have to lose by paying the judgment early. And that's assuming they pay it right away. It's 45 days of interest. It's negligible. And essentially what they're doing, and this goes to Justice Wainer Abner's question earlier on about, is it before versus after? The fact of the matter is in the Gottschall case that the defendant paid the judgment to try to block the appeal. And the court very specifically said that the final point requiring our attention is the contention that the plaintiff's cross appeal is moot in view of the payment to the plaintiff and the warrant of satisfaction delivered it by the defendant. They then give the timing and then the case continues down at page.
Counsel, why don't we go on to the second issue?
Okay.
I think we have your point on this.
Thank you, Your Honor. So with respect to the second issue, I don't really know what to say other than the statute is very clear. It says that if the.
You're relying on chapter 244. You argue that's the statute that applies, correct?
Yes.
So starting with the big picture, tell us why that's significant here.
So in this case, Linda Bream had two doctors, I believe one of which was a treating physician expert and the other was a pure expert, said she will need this medical treatment in the future. I believe the total amount was about $236,000. They testified directly in line with Model Jury Charge 811I and the Cole versus Sherry case, and also the Pitti case. Cole versus Sherry is a Supreme Court case from the 50s. Pitti is a reported law division case. The testimony was directly in line with that law with respect to future medical treatment. The trial judge barred making the claim at trial for those future medical bills. And why that matters in the real world Justice Rabner, is because she, according to the record and evidence in this case, will probably incur $236,000 in future medical treatment.
So tie this to the statute. Tell us the significance of Chapter 244 as relates to your position.
There's three parts of this. There's three words in the statute, or three, you know, in law school, we had our outlines, you know, this and then A, B, and C. We have three. We got A, B, and C. A, the medical expense is $236,000 exceed what the record reflects was $107,000 left on the PIP policy. There is a shortfall, ergo the future medical bills exceed. The statute then says, or are unpaid. The $236,000 in future medical expenses is unpaid. Third, or C, in my outline, or uncovered. They are uncovered. They are uncovered because the PIP carrier cut the plaintiff off. And the statute goes on. So it matters because we have all three, any of which permits the claim to be made to the jury. I don't know what else to say other than she has $236,000 in future medical expenses, which satisfy all A, B, and C when you only need one.
Sorry, you're referring specifically to the portion of the statute that says all medical expenses that exceed, comma, or are unpaid or uncovered by any injured party's medical expense benefits, personal injury protection limits, regardless of any health insurance coverage, are claimable by any insured party as against all parties. Is that what you're referring to, or is it a different sentence?
That's it, Your Honor. And so, I mean, just to pick out, and I don't know how procedurally we address this, but amicus had, I counted about 28 pages of new cases, new arguments, and new theories, which never were seen in this case before. But I suppose we'll address just some of them.
Before you leave that, let me just ask you this. Why was she cut off? What does the record tell us about why the PIP carrier did not pay more than they did?
The record does not state why she was cut off. There is nothing in the record that states that.
Do you know why she was cut off?
I can state with probably 80 to 90% accuracy why I believe she was cut off, but there's nothing in the record that states that.
And there was no challenge to the cutoff? Was there a challenge to the cutoff?
Okay. Our retainer with our client is limited to the personal injury case. It specifically excludes representing them in any PIP actions. Our office did not file any PIP action, and no other office.
Do you know whether there was a challenge to the cutoff?
I think the parties can stipulate that there was no challenge to the cutoff, although it's not reflected in the record.
Counsel, before you move on, the language you were reading and that Justice Wehner after, also, there's a part of this that you didn't focus on or explain what it means in the context of this sentence. So all medical expenses that exceed or are unpaid or uncovered by any injured party's medical expense benefits PIP limits. What role does that qualifying language play when it says unpaid were uncovered by their PIP limits? But what is the significance of PIP limits being in that sentence?
Well, it's part of the whole PIP statute rubric of Title 39. And under the old rubric, if there were past medical bills that were either paid or payable by PIP, meaning they were actually paid by PIP, where they could be payable by PIP because it's subject to the policy, et cetera, then you can't get them in evidence at trial. And I think that the import of benefits by any injured party's medical expense benefits, personal injury protection limits, connotates that we're in the PIP context.
You see, I would read this to say it's because by using per PIP limits, it's to say anything that exceeds the PIP limit. And interestingly, that's actually the first phrase, exceed or unpaid or uncovered by the limit. Therefore, it's not covered due to the limit. Are you agreeing or disagreeing?
I apologize.
I'm trying to understand what is the significance of the inclusion of PIP limits in that sentence?
Well, it would be our position that the inclusion is it brings it under the PIP rubric, under the PIP statute. And also, if I may, I think the legislative history would speak to that as well, which we pointed out at page 6 of our brief in response to the amicus filing. This is the legislative statement of intent.
So, Council, what were the PIP limits in this case? 250,000, right?
Yes.
You weren't paid 250,000. So how do you fit under exceeds 250,000?
Because first of all, our first argument is that this only deals with past medical bills. The existing law under PITI, which is a law division case from the 70s, it is reported, says the whole PIP bar provision doesn't even apply in the case of future medical bills. All the cases deal with past medical bills. So our number one position would be that it doesn't matter because we're in the future medical bills situation. And PITI has been good law for 49 years, by the way.
But this is a new statutory language, is it not, since 2019?
Correct, which makes it even more pro admitting medical bills when they are not paid or not covered.
But if this only applied to past medical bills, wouldn't the legislature, given everything, all the case law that exists on this issue, not this particular issue, but on in general and how PIP operates, wouldn't the legislature have said all past medical expenses that exceed are unpaid or uncovered? If it was simply referring to just past medical expenses. It says all medical expenses.
Wouldn't it not help you anyway if it's only giving you a right to recover for past medical expenses and you're trying to get future medical expenses? I thought your whole point is that the amended statute changed the law and now future medical expenses are allowed.
Well, our position is that any medical expenses that are unpaid or uncovered or exceed are permissible, any of them.
Correct, but if you read the statute only to apply to past medical expenses, then that wouldn't be true. So you can't be reading the statute only to apply to past medical expenses.
But if the statute only applies to past medical expenses, then there's nothing barring future medical expenses, statute or otherwise. And in fact, the PITI case read, the PITI court law division read that statute as only applying to past medical expenses, saying, quote, I find no, and this is at the end of the decision at page 150, quote, I find no basis in the New Jersey Automobile Reparation Reform Act or its legislative history, particularly NJSA 39:A-12, mandating any substantial change in the law of damages or warranting removal from consideration by the fact finder of the usual damage elements regarding future medical treatment. So
do you think that rather than look at the statutory language, we should be looking at this old case that preceded a number of different permutations of the PIP statute?
Well, I think the case is instructive authority, clearly not binding.
But I thought your argument was look at 244, chapter 244. So, and you cited that particular language. Aren't you saying that applies?
I was citing the amended version of the statute primarily to highlight that the law division disregarded the amended version because the court had a philosophical disagreement with medical expenses.
Okay, but here we are, and we're being asked to interpret the statute. That's what the whole second half of your appeal is about. So should we or should we not look to that sentence for guidance, the one that's just been read, beginning with all medical expenses?
I think the court clearly needs to look at that for guidance. You know, perhaps one way to look at it would be to say that because this is a future medical bills case, the statute doesn't apply at all, following the pity.
If the statute doesn't apply at all for two future medical cases, then what you're saying to us is don't look at Chapter 244.
I suppose the primary position would be because it's future medical bills cases, adopt the pity analysis, which is it doesn't apply at all, because if the legislature, as the court said, if the legislature wanted it to apply to future medical expenses, they specifically would have said that. But the defense and the court.
The legislature said all medical expenses. All medical expenses. And that all is one of those words that loop in everything there is.
But the futures aren't yet there.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. I thought that your argument was that the statute was amended and the trial court ignored the statutory amendment. But now it seems like you're saying the statutory amendment is completely irrelevant, and so the trial court was correct to ignore it.
The trial court didn't ignore it. The trial court used the old version of the statute to bar the claim for future medical expenses because of a philosophical disagreement with future medical expenses.
Correct, but pointing out that he used the old version of the statute implies that the new version is somehow different in a way that matters. But now you're saying that the new version of the statute is not different in any way that matters, and the statutory amendment is completely irrelevant, and we could apply the law that existed 50 years ago and it would be the same.
Well, I think it's a two-pronged presentation. Number one is just apply pity and we can all go home. That is the first case that we cited. That's the first case that we cited to the trial court, which is pity, that this is future expenses, therefore the PIP bar doesn't apply. Two, even if the PIP bar does apply, it was amended in 2019 to permit the situation we have here, according to the defense argument, which is that the futures is encapsulated in that umbrella. But again, pity has been around for 49 years. It's key cited as positive. There's nothing overturning that. So
just one question. Pity was not interpreting this sentence because this sentence is brand new to the statute.
That's true. Fair? 100% correct.
Chapter 244 also has another sentence that we haven't talked about yet. And that is that evidence of the amounts collectible under a standard automobile insurance policy is inadmissible in a civil action for recovery of damages. On this record, has there been any determination made about whether the future medical expenses are collectible under PIP?
Sorry, I'm not, Your Honor, Justice Patel, I don't see that section in the
beginning of the statute.
Okay.
Starts off with inadmissibility of evidence of losses collectible under PIP.
Right.
Evidence of the amounts collectible, ... under a standard automobile insurance policy, ... is inadmissible in a civil action for recovery of damages. So first, there has to be a determination made about whether the future medical expenses are collectible. Has there been a determination made in this case that the future medical expenses are not or are collectible under PIP?
Yes, the record is undisputed, and I would posit stipulated that the insurance company cut off Linda Bream.
Where is the cut off PIP letter? I'd like to read that, because that would tell us exactly why they cut her off. Did they cut her off because the existing bill may not have been reasonable or necessary, or did they cut her off because of something that might or might not might happen in the future? I'd like to read the cutoff letter. So I mean, it's maybe undisputed that they cut her off, but I don't know why they cut her off. Let's assume that there was no determination made about whether future medical expenses were collectible under PIP. And let's further assume that we agree with your contention that you're entitled to a new trial to put into evidence future medical expenses as part of your damages claim. Who determines whether that future medical expense claim is collectible or not collectible under Chapter 244?
Well, I think the court would make that determination.
Okay, so the trial judge would.
Correct, but we would have to read the statute, I guess, I'm not good with Latin stuff, but in pari amite with the last paragraph, which says nothing in this section shall be construed to limit the right of recovery, meaning this section gets rid of that inquiry.
Well, what would the trial judge do when addressing whether the future medical expenses are collectible under PIP? How does that judge make that determination on remand, assuming we get
whether or not they're collectible?
Under PIP, correctly. Correct.
Well, I would argue to the trial judge, you need not make that determination because the last paragraph of the statute eviscerates that inquiry by saying nothing in this section shall be construed to limit the right of recovery against the tortfeasor of uncompensated economic loss as defined by subsection K. And then they go down to specifically say all medical expenses that exceed or unpaid or uncovered. And when we look at the legislative...
You just skipped important language, which says including all uncompensated medical expenses not covered by the personal injury protection limits applicable to the injured party. So that brings it back in. If it was covered by PIP, that may be excluded. So that's why Justice Fischelli is asking you whether or not there should be a determination made first about what was the universe of PIP benefits that are covered before looking at whether or not there's possible future medical expenses. It's two separate inquiries. And we don't have anything in the record about what the cutoff was, what was collectible, what was available under PIP before the argument was made that everything should be included that is not PIP.
Okay. Well, when we look at the model jury charge, it cites directly to the Parker case at footnote 3. Now, it cites to the Parker versus Esposito case, which is an appellate division case from 1996, which I discussed in our papers. In order for a court to bar a future, and this is goes back to Judge Wehner Abner, my point that we should all go home early because the statute, we're not even in the realm of the statute. I'm only going to the statute because the defense brought up the statute. The first time in this case, I brought up the Pitty case. Because we're in the future medical bills section, we're in this future medical bills reign. There is strong case law that says the only way an insurance policy will bar a claim for future benefits if there is today an immutable right to those benefits in the future. The Parker case talks about that. And because insurance companies can go out of business or a whole other reasons why they may not have an immutable right to that coverage at some uncertain point in the future, following the Parker case, the future claim should not be barred. The Parker case, if I'm not mistaken, dealt with a Medicare. So because you have a collateral source rule that says you can't double dip. And by the way, in this case, this is negative double dipping. She has an uncompensated loss that she's not allowed to make a trial. So that's just a basic fairness. But even in the Medicare context, if someone will become 65 and eligible for Medicare, that future Medicare benefit does not bar the claim today for future medical bills because there is not today an immutable right to the Medicare benefits in the future because anything could change. That's why in this future context, and again, they the 311I at footnote 3 specifically says, see Parker versus Esposito for application of collateral source rule to future benefits. Because we're in a future benefit situation here, again, this goes to fundamental fairness.
But Mr. Clark, we're here on a petition for certification in which you wrote, the trial court was clearly wrong in disregarding the amended statute which provides that uncompensated medical bills are recoverable at trial. You were relying on the statute and making the argument that the 244, not 245 applies. So I got to say, I'm startled to hear that it's not the governing statute here.
Well, the situation here is this is a future medical bills claim, and that is different from all the other cases. They were all, even the Haynes case was past the medical bills.
Right, but I understood your petition, which was granted, to be premised in part, obviously there are two issues, but premised in part on an argument that chapter 244 governs and it authorizes your client to make this claim for future medical bills. And that's what I just went back to it to make sure I was remembering it correctly, but it really does make that argument. So where are we? I mean, what is the, what's this, why would you be saying the statute doesn't apply? I just don't understand it.
Well, I suppose that would have been a mistake on my part to not also include perhaps, I believe there was two questions presented. It was the mootness and then the statute.
Right. No, and I don't mean in any way to say that that's the only argument that you made, but I took from your petition that you were relying on Chapter 244 when it came to the substantive argument that you're hoping the court will get to and get past mootness.
Upon reflection, it would have been better to draft it by saying one, mootness, two, pity, three, even if not pity, or three, even if not pity, the statute.
I'm just looking at your table of citations. I don't see pity. I know there was another brief, though. Maybe in your supplemental brief, you mentioned it.
You did have pity in the appellate brief. Begins at page 14, at least according to the table of contents. Yes, and that is accurate. We also, I believe we cited pity in our response to the amicus.
Should we take from this?
I did not cite it in response to the amicus. I just want to be clear on that. But we definitely cited it in our pretrial brief on the eliminate to the trial judge. That's what we opened up with. And it's in the trial transcripts as well.
Apart from what was cited and what wasn't, is plaintiff contending that we should look to Chapter 244 to find a right to future medical expenses asserted in the lawsuit that we're now reviewing?
I have a client to represent, and the best interest of my client is to permit the future medical bills claim and remand for a trial. In advocating for my client, I feel it's fair to discuss pity and say that with pity in a future medical bills claim, if this court finds that pity is good law, that will moot out the statutory argument because it's a future medical bills claim. In advocating for my client, I would say if pity does not apply, or we're saying the statute includes the future medical bills, that it covers that, then I go to that question presented in the cert petition.
You also at the outset of the second part of the argument today said this statute 244 applies because there are three triggers: exceed, unpaid, and uncovered, and we hit on all of them. You stand by that argument as well?
Assuming this court finds that
as your third position, if you
correct, in 100% candor with the court. I cited pity early on. That was my thing. But in preparing and frankly preparing further, it came out more about that we're in this future medical bills realm as well. So I accept 100% responsibility for not being as clear as I should have been in that regard. But in my view, it's a sort of a second line of defense, so to speak. And focusing on the judge's decision below, the court below, meaning the trial court, did not address the pity analysis at all. And it was just assumed in the decisions that the future medical bills falls within that umbrella. But certainly certainly this court has unlimited options. But one of the options would be to find that, because this is limited to future medical bills. It's not pain and suffering. It's not wages, which is completely separate jury charges. One option this court would to say that it doesn't apply at all because we're dealing with future medical bills, i.e. the pity analysis.
Respectfully, we don't have unlimited options. We have the legislature with the PIP statute, which it amends is amended a number of times, pays a lot of attention to, amended in response to the Haynes case most recently that we're talking about. So we have a statute. We can't simply just decide what the policy should be. That's the legislature's determination.
The only final thing I would just point out is that even assuming we still have an exceed situation because the record reflects there was about $107,000 left on the policy, even though we say it doesn't apply because they cut her off and therefore we're under the other prong, probably B. So there's $107,000 arguably left with a $236,000 future medical bills claim. So even under all that rubric, we're in an exceed situation, and that's important.
So your argument is that we should find for your client one way or another, but one way is to apply the exceed language in Chapter 244?
Correct. Correct, Justice Patterson. Yes. Again, I'm here. We have the Defense Association here. My duty is to my client, clients in the future, or how is the world going to respond to this? And
are you certain you want to rely on the word exceed the benefit limits when the limits in this case are 250? Or do you want to rely on all three of those?
All three, because much of it, it's been, I don't have a calculator in front of me, but it's
107,000
is left over. So it's 250 minus
143, right?
107 is left to be paid under the 250. I'm just asking if you really want to put all your eggs in the verb exceed.
It'd be 236 minus 107 would be the shortfall that she would have, probably have in the future.
Put the numbers to one side. You didn't get 250.
Yeah.
Do you want to rely on exceed 250 or do you want to rely on all of the parts of the statute?
All parts. But if you take her past medical bills and add up the future medical bills, they will exceed the $250,000 limits by 147, I think we said.
But not all of it will exceed, as you have an unpaid amount of $107,000.
Correct. Theoretically, there's 100.
You're not giving up 107.
Sorry, Justin.
You're not waiving that 107,000 now. Are you?
Of course not. Right. Well, no, not under the exceed.
That's why I'm asking whether.
But right. But it's unpaid and it's uncovered. That 107 is not there.
That was my question
to you. Yeah, it's not even there.
You focused on exceed. Okay.
It's not even there because they cut her off. And by the way, the PIP statute doesn't say, this statute doesn't say, because that's what the defense is going to say. Well, she could have filed the PIP action and she could have done this and she could have done that. And the statute of limitations, there's nothing in the PIP statute that says that. It doesn't say all expenses that are unpaid unless they could have filed the PIP action and they got it in time and retained a lawyer and fought the insurance. None of that is in there.
Counsel, can you close out? I know you said this earlier. What's the remedy you seek at this point?
We seek the appeal was dismissed on mootness.
As to the second issue, what is the remedy you seek?
A remand to the trial court for a trial that I estimate will take one day or less, which will primarily be our expert's testimony, which has already been done, for a trial limited to the issue of future medical bills. That's it. The jury should be charged and told that a prior jury has found there's a permanent injury already. And it is simply the issue of future medical bills. So to remand to the trial court for a trial limited to the issue of future medical bills. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you. Mr. Massey.
On the issue of mootness, in this case, there was a judgment, a verdict was entered on the 28th. A judgment was filed with the court on July 7th, and the judgment was paid on July 11th. That's the actual date that the check was cashed. Prior to that time, there was nothing in the record about any issue for an appeal. Well, plaintiff's counsel had raised the issue plaintiff didn't raise the issue. The defense actually raised the issue in a limine motion. Moving to bar the medical records, the medical bills under 39-6A-12, there was no indication prior to payment of the judgment that there was going to be an appeal. The warrant was filed on August 8th. It probably was in my office for a day or two before that. But the first letter to the court about any issue concerning the appeal is July 27th. Well, there is no provision in Rule 448 that the warrant is the end of the case. The presumption is a warrant brings finality. It's not just a record keeping. It brings finality to an entire proceeding in that a judgment's removed from the record and your client can proceed without worry of the outstanding judgment. Rule 241A does permit 45 days but to file a notice of appeal, but contrary to what counsel said, this would be a post-judgment situation, not a pre-judgment interest situation. And the interest rate on post-judgment is significant. It's much higher. At the time, not having the rule in front of me, I believe it was either 8 or 9% post-judgment. So there was incentive to pay the judgment and bring finality to the proceeding without any indication that there was going to be an appeal.
Counsel, please go ahead.
Go ahead, Your Honor.
Nope, you have 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to move to the second issue in terms of the statutory construct that we try these cases under. We try automobile cases, and I try a lot of them, knowing that rule or that NJSA 39-6812, the entire statute is considered, not one sentence. The very beginning of the statute says collected or collectible or paid. In this case, the issue is collectible. The whole construct of the statute and its subsequent amendments after the Haynes decision, the ACRA amendments, is two, that we don't want medical bills being part of trials. Two, we don't want to clog the court with issues related to medical bills. And contrary to what counsel says, there is a provision. It's NJSA 39-6A 5.1, which talks about the remedies if you don't get your PIP paid. Here, what plaintiff wants to do is circumvent the statutory construct of the no-fault statute and say, once we get denied our medical bills, we can just say, oh, they're now admissible at a trial. That's not what the statute provided for. Under Section 5 and Section 51A, you have the right to pursue the payment of those medical bills. You prevail, you get, not only do you get your medical bills, you get a counsel fee, you get interest payments. If 39-6812 is to be read as plaintiff would like it to be read in this case, then we should eliminate the very first paragraph of 39-6812, which says collectible or paid, because the statute wants you to exhaust your remedies. And if you lose at an arbitration, and I argue that the Habeck case says, you can't come back and bring those up at time of a trial. Here, what plaintiff wants to say is, we're not gonna do anything. We're gonna let the bills remain outstanding. And then say, oh, they're admissible as our elements of damage. And I believe that would be contrary to the entire statutory construct of the no-fault statute.
Can I take you, have you finished your?
Yes.
Let's go back to waiver for a moment.
Well, I'm sorry.
Let's go back to the issue of mootness and
sir.
I have to say that I've never encountered a situation quite like this in terms of a check being issued and cashed, and a warrant to satisfy judgment happening so fast after a judgment when there are some contested issues potentially floating around there, even though it appears that the record is that you that there was no direct indication there would be an appeal.
It's not part of the record, Your Honor. I don't want to get into
it.
I don't want to get into what happened behind the scenes.
No privilege, but I gotta say, it strikes me as unusual because in the normal, you know, there's a judgment is entered. There's sure. usually some level of contested issue somewhere where the party that lost might be filing an appeal, or the party that prevailed may be filing an appeal as well, depending on what issues were out there. And all of a sudden we've got the check issued and cashed and a warrant to satisfy judgment in a flurry of activity right after judgment. And I'm hesitant to even ask you this question because it may get into privileged information, which I am not requesting at all. However, why doesn't this come up more often if there's a requirement to tell the plaintiff, tell the defendant, I'm going to appeal. And you can still give me a check if you want, but you don't have to. See what I'm saying?
Your Honor, I wish I had an answer, but I don't. In this case, what happened was, candidly, the judgment was docketed, and plaintiff's counsel, again, some part of the record, pushed for payment, and I made sure the payment was
plaintiff's counsel. I'm sorry.
Plaintiff's counsel had pushed for payment of the judgment.
And you were trying to get it resolved.
Judge, in fact, it was FedEx directly by my principal, not me.
Counsel, if you know, and only if you can answer without stepping over the privilege.
Yes.
We heard an argument earlier that plaintiff needed the money and was in difficult financial straits. Did that factor into the timing of the check?
Absolutely not. That was never a part of the case. It wasn't an issue. I don't believe there's any testimony in the record anywhere about that. That was not a consideration.
Can you explain to me? Let's make believe we're now at the trial.
Yeah.
Plaintiff's got $107,000 left in her PIP policy. Her doctors are telling her she needs future medical treatment in excess of $250,000, roughly, or somewhere around that.
$236,000, okay. Exact.
What recourse does that plaintiff have at that point? Because the PIP policy has not been exhausted, what does the plaintiff do at that point?
The plaintiff has complete recourse under the statute in sections 5 and 5.1 to file a claim against her PIP carrier.
Okay, so she's got to pursue an action against the PIP carrier and maybe get an arbitration award. But that's only going to cover the 107.
That's the problem. That's what we don't know, Your Honor. Because, again, the number that's being thrown out of 236,000 in the record are just rounded numbers.
But they're allowed to do that with a future medical.
That's a good question for another case, Your Honor, because I'm not so sure that's the case, but that's for another appeal.
It doesn't have to be a mathematically precise number.
It does not have to be a mathematically precise number. But the plaintiff has the right to file an arbitration to say the termination of my PIP benefits was improper.
But the only thing they could terminate her for would be the 107, right? There's nothing above that they can say we're not paying because they're not obligated to pay to begin with.
Correct. But, you know, facts kind of do matter in the case. There's no proof of any treatment for the 3 years prior to the trial.
Well, let's assume there is. For purposes of Justice Fischelli's question, let's assume that 236 number. And answer the question assuming that 236 number. Because I think all of us want to understand how the math would work in this regard. Couldn't, in a sense... And I think if you don't mind, Justice, sure. I think what Justice Fischelli is going toward is, doesn't this plaintiff still have a right to come to court for $129,000, which is 236 minus the amount that's already been, minus the amount that did
minus
the delta between?
I understand the question. There's going to be some differential between the 236 and the 107.
And what happens there?
Right.
Well, I would argue that, one, that's pure speculation. I know it doesn't have to be perfect. I argue that in this case, we don't know that. And we can't answer it here. In the hypothetical, yes. If the PIP had been exhausted, they could come and seek further treatment.
The judge can always mold the verdict afterwards and say, okay, there's a future medical award. The jury awards future medical expenses in the amount of $250,000. The judge can mold that verdict and say, well, you're only entitled to the excess amount above the PIP limits, and then let the plaintiff try to pursue the PIP carrier for that 107. Is that? Yeah.
Yes, that theoretically could be the way it got resolved.
But it didn't. Assume, I know you're taking the position Chapter 245 applies, but assume Chapter 244 applies. When you're applying Chapter 244, does it matter why she was cut off? And if you could answer that with reference to the language of the statute that we were just looking at, exceed, unpaid, uncovered.
But it says, Your Honor, when they talk about exceed, it says, or unpaid or uncovered by any injured party's medical expense benefits, personal protection limits.
Okay, so.
So yep. I don't think it makes a difference whether we apply 244 or 245, because the only difference in 244 and 245, Your Honor, is whether or not the fee schedule applies. Okay. If you look at the bottom of 240.
That's not really an issue in this case.
It's not an issue. Okay.
So I know you took the position 245 apply, but let's assume 244 applies. I'm not asking you to concede anything on that, but just.
I will there. In a second.
Well, please go ahead. What does this mean? All medical expenses that exceed or are unpaid or uncovered by any injured parties, medical expense benefits, personal injury protection limits, regardless of any coverage, et cetera. What does that mean in the context of this case?
You're right. You have to read the whole statute. You have to go back to the initial paragraph.
Okay. So take it, just walk us through, unless this will try anybody's patience. Walk us through
using my analysis. Okay. My analysis is this, Your Honor.
Okay.
They allegedly have unpaid medical bills, future unpaid medical bills. However, we don't know what those bills are, other than the testimony of the doctors. And again, that would be a different issue.
Sorry, I thought your analysis was of the statute, not of the particulars of this case.
Right. In this case, going to the statute, if it's collectible, we know there's at least $107,000 of medical bills that could still be paid through her PIP.
Okay. So I'm going to stop you for a moment. Does it matter with respect to whether it's collectible under the statutory language, whether the PIP carrier took the position that the bills were proper, the expenses were not properly documented, or that she somehow waived it, or whatever it was? Does it matter why they cut her off in order to determine whether a particular amount was collectible?
I don't think that makes the difference about whether or not it's collectible. If the plaintiff failed to pursue the remedies, then it's not collectible, but that doesn't make it admissible, Your Honor. So if you took that approach, we'd eviscerate the entire PIP. And
we need to take this in stages, because that approach, all I'm doing is asking you whether, just simple question, does it matter in order to determine whether it's collectible or not, why they cut her off? And I think you said no. Okay.
No.
So walk us through, knowing what you know about this case, how this statute makes the future medical expenses inadmissible.
Because the medical bills are collectible, potentially under the PIP statute. And in this case, what the plaintiff wants to do is say, I didn't challenge my termination of PIP benefits. So therefore, all my medical bills become admissible. That's important in a bigger context, Your Honor, in that that would encourage every plaintiff in every case to just go get medical treatment, let the PIP carrier terminate them at whatever point, don't show up for an IME, and then say, hey, all my medical bills are admissible.
But I have one more, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues here. So we should look at collectible as within the PIP limits. There's a PIP carrier in this case. It has a $250,000 PIP limit, and there is an amount of money that is short of 250, and that is all collectible.
Yes, and Your Honor, I guess one of your questions was, does it matter why? If the plaintiff just does nothing and just lets their benefits be terminated, it does matter, because then every plaintiff would do that and say, I have an element of damages now. Another aspect is, if the plaintiff is terminated based upon an arbitration hearing, which is what the statute provides for, and the arbitrator makes a decision that you don't need any more medical treatment, they're not collectible at that point. They're not collectible, and they shouldn't be admissible, because that's why we have the whole statutory scheme. If once an arbitrator, I think Habeck kind of stands for this premise, that once an arbitrator rules that your medical treatment is no longer related to a motor vehicle accident, you don't get to say, I want to relitigate that issue in front of a jury.
Okay, so you're saying that in order to have something, the expenses be non-collectible, the plaintiff has to pursue her remedies against her PIP carrier under the PIP statute.
Yes. Otherwise, Your Honor, it would encourage everyone to just, quite frankly, ignore their PIP carrier, which you can't do under the statutory scheme, and say, they're all admissible as my damages at the time of the third party trial.
Ideally, it would be better if the PIP carrier and the plaintiff had resolved whether the plaintiff was entitled to future medical coverage under the PIP limits. But in this case, that did not happen. So if I could just say, they say $236,000 represents the total amount of future medical expenses that this plaintiff would incur. We know that $107,000 was left on the policy. Why couldn't the plaintiff have had an opportunity to put in evidence of future medical expenses and then have the judge mold the verdict afterwards to reduce whatever the award is by the $107,000 that otherwise would be collectible by the PIP carrier?
In this case, Your Honor, that would have been an injustice.
Why?
Because the plaintiff's calculation included 3 years before the trial where there was no treatment.
Okay, so that goes to the pain and suffering calculation.
No, but also go to the medical calculation.
That's what I'm about to say. That goes to how they're intertwined.
Right, and that's one of the other issues.
But I thought if it had been a part of the trial, then you would have been able to cross-examine the witnesses and say, actually, she has had 3 years of no treatment, so your estimate of $236,000 is clearly false because you estimated she would need this and she hasn't needed it, and you estimated she would need that and she hasn't needed it. That's the whole point of a trial, is so that you can cross-examine witnesses and prove why their estimation is false.
And that was done in terms of the pain and suffering that you hadn't.
No, but I'm talking about specific future medical expenses, because your point was she had already had 3 years before trial where she didn't have a medical bill.
Correct.
So I'm saying, is that not an issue that you could then prove at trial?
I could prove that issue at trial.
So then I'm confused. I thought your response to Justice Bashali was, you can't have a situation where it goes to trial on future medical expenses and then subtracts out the $107,000 that was still left to the PIP benefits, because...
I didn't say you couldn't do it. I said, yes, that could be the way to do it. But in this case, to let $236,000 go on the board would be, quite frankly, an absolute misrepresentation.
Again, no one would be letting anything go on the board because the jury would decide whether it's $236,000 or zero or anything in between. And they would decide that based on your skillful cross-examination of the people saying the $236,000 number.
Correct, except if you allowed in this case where there is no treatment, because there is no treatment, the record's clear, there is no treatment for 3 years prior, the plaintiff still wants to argue that. Still wants to say it's $236,000.
So are you saying that there should be some separate rule that has nothing to do with the statute that says if you have an estimation of future medical expenses, but there's a period of several years in which you don't incur those, then you lose the ability to argue them? I'm just confused as to where in the statute do we find that?
But we don't, Your Honor, but we do try cases on facts. And if facts don't exist and there is no medical bill, why is it presented for a jury as an element of damages? It doesn't exist.
So now we're not talking about statutory interpretation. We're just talking about the specific facts of this case.
Well, Your Honor, the way you asked me the question, yes, I'm talking the specific facts of this case. But in any case in which we don't have, could be any case, there's a 5-year period before trial that we don't have any medical bills, yet they want to put on future medical bills. And again, the way it was presented in this case was it's going to average $12,500 a year. And for her life expectancy is 20 years, but she hasn't received 5 years of treatment. Why should a jury hear $236,000?
It's misleading. The statute might inform us that that's admissible. And that's really the question. I mean, it's up, as Justice Wiener-Apter just stated, it's up to you to make that call of how to attack that evidence once it's submitted. But the question is it admissible to begin with under this statute? And I need to follow up on a question to you, whether or not, am I mistaken in my understanding that it sounds like you're saying exhaustion is not the definitive issue?
No, I do believe that is the definitive issue.
It sounded like that there's circumstances where PIP could be cut off, that arbitration could be held, that the arbitrator could determine that there is no award for the plaintiff. So there's an amount of PIP that is still in the fund, but just not awarded.
Correct. It's a collateral estoppel issue.
Exhausted in that sense.
I believe the Habeck case stands for that proposition. If you go to arbitration and you lose at the arbitration and the arbitrator, who was appointed pursuant to the statute, says you don't need any further medical treatment, your benefits are terminated, then they would not be collectible or paid under PIP, but it's because they're not part of the case anymore.
And in that case, that would be a situation where they did exhaust their remedies. I know it's the wrong terminology to use. It's like an administrative.
That's the best terminology I could think of. But
she exhausted her remedies under the, she would have exhausted her remedies under the PIP statute had that occurred.
Correct.
And if that's the case, then like you said, the future meds would not be collectible by PIP. Therefore, that amount would be admissible in the trial. Were you about to argue?
No, Your Honor. If you get your benefits terminated because the arbitrator who decides pursuant to the statute under Section 5 and 5.1 that your benefits are terminated, you don't need any further medical treatment, that's binding subsequently in the actual tort trial.
Or the 107, but not for the amount that exceeds the limits.
It would if the termination is you don't need any further treatment. You're done. Your benefits are finished because the arbitrators in PIP make a ruling about whether or not the treatment is medically necessary and causally related. That's what they do in a PIP arbitration. So if they said, no, your benefits are terminated because you don't need any further treatment, then the fact that they say they do, that's already been decided.
Well, we don't know if that's been decided. We haven't seen a PIP cutoff letter. We don't know exactly why the PIP carrier cut her off. We have no idea.
And that's my point, Your Honor. That's why in this case, you should bar the medicals. Because if you don't, it encourages every plaintiff to take the position that, hey, I'm just not going to comply with my PIP carrier. They terminate me, and I just keep running up medical bills because they're not collectible because I didn't comply with the statutory scheme set forth in the no-fault statute. It becomes an element of damages.
The best case scenario is that there's a determination made that the most that would be collectible would be the 107. Under the facts of our case.
But those 107 are collectible under the PIP and would right. not be right. an element of damages in the case.
But you're saying there also could be a situation where the PIP carrier says you don't need any future medicals, you get zero.
Right.
And we can't get to that determination without an arbitration under the PIP statute. And that didn't happen.
Right. But my point is, if you don't comply with the PIP statute, you don't contest anything. So you just get terminated. And then you say, well, I'm terminated. I'm not going to contest it. Now all my bills become medically necessary and therefore admissible. Well, that would be in contravention of the very process set forth in the statute at 39.6A1 through, I think it's 24. Where they set forth the whole parameter. Again, I don't want to rehash it, but the Reformation Act passed in 72 was an effort to control costs and expenses. It was modified in 1999 with the ACRA amendments, and again, modified after the Haynes decision to set forth the procedures. They didn't change any of the PIP procedures, arbitration procedures. All they did was say, if you exhaust your PIP benefits, and they're exhausted, say it's a $15,000 policy and you got $50,000, those $35,000 are now admissible. And it doesn't matter if you look at section 244 or 245, because it has to be, both sections have to be read in the full statutory context. And in the very first paragraph, it talks about being collectible or paid. And then we have to look at the whole statute and what its intent was.
So let's go back to that threshold question in any event. What you've told us is you think 245 applies, but it doesn't matter. 245 says, this is section 3 of the law, this act shall take effect on August 1st, 2019, and shall apply to automobile accidents occurring on or after that date. When was the accident here? What year?
2016.
So how does 245 apply under those express words?
If you look at 244, the language is identical.
Not exactly. 244 says this act shall take effect immediately, and the date was August 15th, 2019. And apply to causes of actions pending on that date or filed on or after that date.
Here there was a cause of action already pending in 2019, but the accident did not happen after 2019. So how could 245 possibly apply instead of 244?
If 245 doesn't apply.
Does it or doesn't it?
If it does not apply.
You're asking in the hypothetical.
No.
Is it your position that it applies or that it doesn't apply?
It's ultimately, it's section 244 that does apply just because of the statutory timeframes. But when you look at the statutory language in each section, the only significant difference in section 245 is that
the schedules.
Yes.
That's why I frankly couldn't figure out when I was reading what you wrote, why you were fighting for 245.
It's an error. Whether it's 244 or 245, the only language differential in those two paragraphs or those sections, 244 and 255, is the final provision that says for all automobile accidents after August 1st, 2019, the PIP fee schedule will apply.
That may affect another case, but it doesn't.
It doesn't affect this case.
I have another question for you. Mr. Clark cited Pitty. He says the answers found in Pitty.
That is a completely misconstruing.
Let me just finish real quickly. He says the answers found in Pitty, and he doesn't even have to go to the statute unless we reject his view of Pitty. I'm kind of guessing I know the answer, but what's defendant's position regarding the Pitty? Relevance of Pitty?
Pitty clearly said that medical bills are not admissible. What Pitty said was future medical treatment, just like in every case that we try, that the doctor says in the future, you might need this, you might need that, or you, within a reasonable degree of medical probability, you're going to need 4 more epidural injections, you're going to need a right shoulder surgery. That's what Pitty says. It says that, yes, testimony to future medical treatment is always admissible. And I'm not saying it's not in this case.
But you said in your brief, page 7, that evidence of, under Pitty, evidence of dollar amounts collectible in the future was deemed inadmissible pursuant to 6A12.
Correct.
So you're saying Pitty helps you?
Yeah, Pitty absolutely.
I think Pitty decided in 1975 has never had as much attention as it's having this afternoon.
Probably never cited to it before because it doesn't stand for anything to do, in essence, with the admissibility of medical bills. It just says, listen, you don't bring medical bills in. In fact, the language of the concern of the no-fault statute was to eliminate reliance on arbitrary formulas applying or encouraging multiple damages. And it goes on to say that what is admissible, and there's no one contesting that in this case, is that the plaintiff's doctors can get on and say, you're going to need 2 more epidurals every year the rest of your life. You're going to need a fusion in the future. That is always admissible.
So when is the future medical expenses jury charge given?
It would be given where there's an absolute exhaustion of the PIP, and I'll use a hypothetical. The plaintiff only has a $15,000 PIP policy. The injuries are a lacerated spleen and a fractured back that required immediate medical treatment in terms of surgery, fusion to the spine. Medical bills are $250. There's only $15. Those $245,000 would clearly be admissible.
Okay, then let me ask you this question. Let's assume, just for the sake of this question, that we conclude the judge mistakenly excluded evidence of future medical expenses on remand. Is the trial limited to future medical expenses, or is it do the whole thing again because essentially personal injury awards are generally not divisible?
We'd have to retry the entire case, Your Honor. We can't go back.
Not liability.
No, it wasn't a liability case anyway, Your Honor. It would be a damages only trial. We would have to retry the entire case because the jury can't just hear from the doctors. That's not the proofs in the case. The jury would have to hear from the plaintiff again, all of the plaintiff's medical expert witnesses again. They'd have to hear from my expert medical witnesses. So to say that it would just be simply, well, I'm going to call 2 doctors and we're going to have these are the medical bills. Well, that's not what the trial would be. The trial would be a retrial of all damages in the case.
That goes back to your argument on mootness, because the judgment that your client paid would then be undone.
Correct.
Except that it's been paid.
Exactly.
Anything else you'd like to add?
That's all I have.
Thank you. Mr. Fuller.
Good afternoon, and thank you for permitting me to be here. I'm going to try and stick to the highlights based upon the colloquy that I've heard so far and try to hone in on some of the points that I think the court is interested in. I agree initially with Mr. Mazzi, known him for quite a while, I forget his name. Mr. Mazzi, if you read Pitty will specifically tell you that the facts of the future treatment are admissible, the costs thereof are not. So Pitty offers no support for the plaintiff in this case. The fee schedule is important in this case. And Chief Justice Rabner, I doubt you will remember, but when I was here before you in Haines, before I sat down, I gave you the example of the case that I was going to try the following day in Union County. That was one in which a man had had a one-level lumbar fusion. His $15,000 PIP limit had been exceeded. And between the hospital and the doctor, they said that the cost of this treatment is $700,000. I used it as an example of what we're facing in the trial courts. In that case, because we weren't dealing with fee scheduled numbers, we were dealing with what's usual, customary, and reasonable charges. And I said to the court, the doctors in the hospital want $700,000. The plaintiff has an expert who says the usual, customary, and reasonable cost of treatment is $310,000. And I have an expert who says the cost of treatment is actually $250,000. At the end of the day, the jury awarded $250,000 for the medical expenses. What one might argue was smaller numbers for the actual injury itself is only $70,000. But the point being is that the amounts charged by the doctors are not the ones that necessarily govern the recovery. And with respect to cases that are subject to the PIP statute, the fee schedule applies. And so the fee schedule would apply in this case to all of the bills that were claimed as future medical expenses, all of those $236,000, so that it is speculative to say that those medical expenses would exceed the fee schedule, would exceed $250,000, because we don't know what the fee schedule would pay for those things.
So 245 specifically speaks to the fee schedules, of course.
Those are,
if 244 applies in this case by virtue of the effective dates, does it?
With respect to medical expenses which exceed the PIP policy limit. The medical expenses that are still within the policy limit are still subject to the fee schedule. So that a doctor submits a bill for, say, I think one of the examples in this case was future carpal tunnel surgery. It was estimated by Dr. Kim that the cost of the surgery would be $5,000 to $10,000. Just taking that bill in and of itself, when Dr. Kim or whomever performs that carpal tunnel procedure and bills the PIP carrier, say $10,000, the PIP carrier applies the fee schedule and pays ordinarily significantly less than that. So we're in a situation where, yes, if the medical expense benefit limit is exceeded, those medicals become recoverable. But
what is the NJDA's position with respect to the issue of the statute? I thought you agreed that 244 applied.
Yes.
So you're saying that the distinction between 244 and 245 is not fee schedules are in one case and out in the other. You're saying that to some degree, even under 244, the fee schedules apply.
The fee schedules clearly apply to the unexhausted amount of the benefit.
So in this case, to the 250 limit that applies under the policy.
Correct. So for example, I'll just use round numbers, say there's 150 that's already been paid. There's 100 remaining to be paid. There are $230,000 to $36,000 of medical expenses being claimed as necessary in the future. Those $236,000 are subject to fee schedule reductions because they don't exceed. So it's the fee schedule numbers don't apply to excess numbers under 244, but they do apply under 245, which I would submit is an indication that the legislature did not intend to change the first party system of benefits that, you know, was enacted in 1972 with the PIP statute, and that the fee schedule remains the basis upon which to help to control these costs. So
are you agreeing with defendant that there has to be an exhaustion of PIP before one can talk about any possible benefits above the $250,000. So I understood defendant to be arguing that it's the arbitrator in PIP who gets to determine how much any future medical expenses would be and whether they would be more or less than $107,000. And so whether there would then be anything over the $250,000 limit, and that you have to go to the PIP arbitrator to make that decision. You can't just decide, okay, I'm not going to object to getting cut off from PIP, and instead I'm going to sue and I'm going to try to convince a jury that I have $236,000 in future medical benefits.
I think the answer to your question is no, I don't necessarily agree with the construct that says you have to show that $250,000 has been spent in order to talk about future medicals. The actual procedure under the PIP statute does not present questions of future medical to arbitrators unless it's presented in the context of, say, a doctor specifically, there's pre-authorization procedures. A doctor seeks pre-authorization to perform a surgical procedure. If the PIP carrier denies the pre-authorization, then the patient, the claimant, has the ability to demand and go to arbitration and have an arbitrator determine whether or not that surgical procedure is reasonable and necessary. But you would not...
That's not a future medical expense. That's a current one that they're debating about whether it can actually happen, correct? Like, the doctor sought pre-authorization, so they correct. Want it to happen now. It just hasn't happened yet because the PIP insurer is saying it doesn't have to.
Correct. But that's the situation in which a PIP arbitrator would consider the issue of future medical expenses.
So you're disagreeing with defendants. There's no required exhaustion of PIP remedies when it comes to future medical expenses. It's not the arbitrator who gets to decide how much will your medical care cost in the next 10 years or in 8 years from now. And a jury can decide that.
No. If I said that, I misspoke.
Can I ask you a slightly different? I thought I understood counsel as saying that she never reached her PIP limit of 250 based on the medical expenses she'd incurred to date, and that she was cut off for reasons that are mysterious in this case, and nobody seems to have the answer on why she was cut off. I think what I heard defense counsel saying is that a person in the position of plaintiff can't simply say, too bad, I'm assuming I'm cut off and I'm going to go after the defendant's insurer for this.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. Agree with that. Okay. I apologize if I wasn't clear, but.
Yeah, I think you were answering a different question than perhaps the defense counsel was at.
Well, I think the point that I was trying to make is that if the plaintiff can establish that the future medical will exhaust the PIP limit through the application of the fee schedule, then you have the ability to make that future claim. But
who does the plaintiff have to establish that to? A PIP arbitrator or a jury?
For the purposes of this, that would have to be to a jury. If you're talking about, so
I thought defendant was saying it's the PIP arbitrator, and then you get collaterally estopped, and you can't re-argue that in front of a jury because the PIP arbitrator's decision is final, and you have to go to a PIP arbitrator first.
That's correct. There is a collateral estoppel effect to a determination made at PIP arbitration, but I'm talking to the situation that you're faced with here. In other words, there was no request that the PIP arbitrator overturn the decision to terminate benefits for whatever reason. But what I'm saying is that in order to establish that there is going to be an exhaustion of the PIP limit by virtue of this future treatment, it has to be shown, and it's the plaintiff's burden in this instance to show that those future medical expenses will exhaust the PIP limit and will exhaust the PIP limit based upon fee scheduled amounts rather than just simply the doctor's testimony.
But does she get that from a jury or does she get it from the PIP carrier? Does she have to try? I'll try to ask it as simply as I can. Does she have to try to get the money out of the PIP carrier first, one way or another?
The way the PIP arbitration works is It's a dispute resolution process so that when the carrier and the claimant have a dispute as to whether certain treatment should be paid for, that's what they take up. There's no procedure to go into a PIP arbitration and say, I want you to tell me on October 7th, 2024, that I'm entitled to PIP benefits of, I think it was $12,500 a year for the rest of my life. That's not,
no, yeah, that's not, my
not PIP it's arbitration. What I'm saying is because you then take the PIP status as you find it when you get to trial, and to the extent that the plaintiff is seeking future medical expenses, which fall within the $250,000 PIP limit, they are not recoverable. And I would submit that
she either gets them from the PIP carrier or not at all. Is that your position?
Well, yes. If it's within that $250,000, she needs to correct.
Within the limits.
I thought you were saying that you can't go to get future medical. I'm now much more confused. I thought you just said that you cannot get future medical expenses from a PIP arbitrator, and PIP arbitrators, the only thing they're deciding is current medical expenses. And can this be chargeable or can this not? It has to be due now. It cannot be what you're going to need in 10 years.
Correct. But what I'm saying is, in the context of the damages which are being sought in this case, in order to establish a claim for medical expenses which exceed the PIP limit, you need to be able to establish that these bills that these doctors are talking about are going to exceed the PIP limit.
Correct, and but what we keep asking is, who establishes that? PIP arbitrator or a jury?
Well, in that instance, it's a jury.
Okay.
With respect to the future.
Can I ask you a question, a hypothetical, to sort of nail that point down? Let's say that the plaintiff has $250 in PIP, spends $150 in current medical treatment, is undergoing treatment up until the point of trial. There's still $100 left in PIP. At trial, they're seeking to show that there's a surgery that is being recommended for $500,000. The fee schedule suggests that that should only cost $300,000. So you're suggesting, and if I'm following it correctly, that they would try to prove to a jury that that $300,000 is collectible and is $200 over the PIP limit.
That's correct under that hypothetical. Right. But if you're talking about a surgery which has been recommended and
to take place now,
then the question is whether or not the PIP carrier has authorized that and whether or not the plaintiff has exhausted their remedies through the arbitration and dispute resolution procedures.
But if its trial is now and the doctor is saying they're going to need this surgery in the future and this is the amount it would cost, it's not being currently debated, but it's the doctor testifying that this is a future surgery that will have to take place at some point. This person's shoulder or knee will give out and they will need this surgery, and this is what it would cost. Then is that now a bills that they can submit as a future medical expense when the PIP has not yet been exhausted because they're currently under treatment and just hasn't been exhausted yet at the time of trial?
I would accept that once you've established what the fee scheduled amounts on that future treatment would be, you would have the ability to make that claim.
Before a jury.
Assuming you have, to whatever extent necessary, perfected your PIP claim. Okay, because what we're really talking about in this instance is the plaintiff, and in the response to my amicus brief, plaintiff's counsel indicated that the PIP benefits, the remaining $107,000 in this case, is not collectible because the statute of limitations on the PIP claim has expired. In other words, 2 years or more have passed since the last payment of benefits, which would establish the statute of limitations.
And your argument is that she's not allowed to let the statute run and then just say, I'm out of luck.
Correct.
Is it your understanding that that's why she was cut off? Statute of limitations had run?
No. My understanding is, and I can't tell you where I got it from other than from reading the papers that have been submitted. My understanding was that there was a termination of benefits based upon an independent medical examination in which the PIP carrier decided that there was no further treatment required. And that was not challenged.
Counselor, if I just follow up on one thing, as you said earlier, and I think as you repeated to Justice Wehner after, the arbitrator is not going to or does not consider the issue of future medical expenses. If that's the case, doesn't that make future medical expenses not collectible and therefore admissible?
No. The fact that future treatment may take place, for which there is PIP coverage and there are PIP benefits available. In other words, take that situation and you look at it and you say, okay, you're going to need a carpal tunnel surgery in a year's time. Okay. The arbitrator decides whether or not they agree with that or whatever the case may be.
The arbitrator does consider future medical expenses.
If presented in the context of, I need this surgery, authorize me to have the surgery.
And it's not whenever. Future, it's current. That's what we're debating. It seems right. Like future medical expenses are, in 5 years, you will need this surgery.
Right.
It seemed like you had said the PIP arbitrator never decides that. Only the jury decides that, what you're going to need in 5 years.
That's correct. But again, I go back to the amount that's remaining on the PIP limit. In other words, the amount that's remaining on the PIP limit is still collectible and still payable under PIP.
But not if the arbitrator is not going to consider the issue. How can it be collectible under the PIP if the arbitrator doesn't consider the issue?
Because there's no opportunity for it to arise if you're talking solely about future medical expenses.
So, or it's not collectible.
Well, no, it is collectible.
It's collectible at some point in the future. There's no actual time limit on PIP. So if it takes you this long to get all your treatment in PIP, as long as you never have a PIP cutoff letter that says we're not paying anymore, you can keep seeking every time you need more treatment, even if that takes a while. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. I mean, there's case law.
What about the 2-year statute of limitations?
Well, there's Your Honor, there's the Zuppo case way back when, which says if the PIP carrier is on notice, the fact that there is a permanent injury which will require recurrent treatment, then the statute won't.
So someone in plaintiff's position could just hang out, say that there's a potential, give notice that there's a potential issue, and then if the next time she needs medical treatment, can go back to a PIP carrier.
Correct.
But that meant that it's collectible under the PIP statute.
It's still collectible under the statute.
She's been cut off, right? We don't know what that means, but she's been cut off, but she should have remedies against her PIP carrier.
Exactly. And the whole purpose of the PIP statute is to take it out of the third party fault system and put it into the first party system of benefits between the claimant and the carrier, and not to.
So we're just being told she was cut off, but you're saying that assuming she's given proper notice that she may be back to them, she can go back to them.
Well, that's I don't know anything about the facts or circumstances of what the PIP carrier has been told, but that the Zuppo construct is based upon notice in advance of the carrier that,
In my hypothetical, there was no PIP cutoff, but here it's been represented that there was. In my hypothetical, there has not been a PIP cutoff, and so in theory, you can keep requesting more treatment as it's needed.
Well, if you're constantly, in other words, as presented here, all right, the doctors have said that the plaintiff is going to require physical therapy, injections, blah, I don't know specifically, but $12,500 worth of treatment each year. So you are talking about a course of treatment, which as described by the doctors, will continue to be submitted to the PIP carrier and will not result in the expiration of the statute of limitations under your example, Justice Wehner.
They continue to pay.
Because they continue to pay and they continue to treat.
Mr. Foley, I think we need to thank you at this point. Unless there's anything you want to sum up with.
No.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank you. And Mr. Clark, I'm going to limit you to 5 minutes on the clock, because we have 6 lawyers we have yet to hear from.
This is why pity applies, because of all these speculative. The defense has now agreed that you can only go to PIP arbitration if you need the surgery now, it's been pre-approved. But for surgeries that are 5, 10, 15 years down the road, you can't even go to PIP arbitration for it. It has to be a jury. And that's why the law division in Pitti was correct. With respect to plaintiff can hang out and make the claim at some future and be okay on the statute of limitations, that is incorrect. We set that forth in our amicus response brief, specifically 39:6A-13.1 subsection A. It's not collectible under PIP limits because the statute of limitations for time to make a claim has run. And in the statute in question, there's no provision that says, unless you miss the statute of limitations, et cetera, et cetera. Defense says defense attacks the merits of the evidence on the future treatment. They say that there was 3 years before trial and there were no bills. Number one, the record reflects based on the testimony because it was too early for her to have that future treatment in part. One of the future treatments is a future wrist surgery far down the line. Secondly, that is a convenient argument because they cut her off. The reason she couldn't treat for those 3 years is because she had because PIP cut her off, and the record reflects that as well.
I'm sorry, the record reflects that PIP carrier cut her off?
The record reflects that Linda Bream did not treat during that time period before trial because PIP cut her off.
But I thought defendant's point there was, then you should go complain to PIP.
That does not render those unpaid, exceed, or uncovered bills not admissible at trial under the statute. That's my point. The statute doesn't say that. And I'm glad Your Honor asked that question because the legislative history, we set this forth at page 6 of our submission. The bill makes it clear, this is from the Senate, the bill makes it clear that the economic loss in ACRA, otherwise known as the no-fault law, may include economic loss for uncompensated medical expenses. Notwithstanding the longstanding interpretation of that definition in the statute to the contrary, in doing so, the bill codifies the recent holding of the appellate division in Haynes. That legislative history is critical to say that you should have gone back to arbitration because that's the whole history of the statute.
Sorry, I thought though that Haynes was just about if you already hit your PIP limit, but your PIP limit is lower than $250,000. Your PIP limit's only $15,000 or $20,000, then what happens? And I thought the point defendant was making is if you haven't hit your PIP limit yet, then go complain to the PIP insurer. Don't try to bring a separate action.
They do say that, but Mr. Foley candidly conceded when it's future treatment down the road, you can't go to arbitration. You cannot go to the arbitrator and say, make a determination that I will need that neck fusion in 10 years, or as Justice Noriega pointed out, the knee's going to give out and I'm going to need it 10 years down the road. You can't go to arbitration for that. And that was a substantial part of the claim that Judge Wilson below rejected and didn't allow us to bring to the trial. And that's critical.
Did you say the PIP cutoff was 3 years before the trial?
No, the defense, I apologize, Your Honor, the defense was making an argument that attacking the merits of the future medical bills claim because Linda didn't get treatment in 3 years before the trial.
You know when the PIP carrier cut her off?
The letter is not in the record. And so the answer is no. Certainly I could dig it out in the file and find it, but it's not part of the record.
But you separately did say that the reason she wasn't getting the treatment is because she had been cut off.
Correct.
So that's why Justice Fischalli guessed that perhaps the cutoff was before the 3 years that she wasn't getting the treatment.
The record does reflect that the cutoff was prior to the trial. In the trial colloquy among counsel was in agreement that she was cut off before trial. The only other thing I would state, first of all, it's 236,000 minus the 107 left leaves $129,000 shortfall, which is an estimate. The number can go up or down pursuant to the jury charge on medical bills. The one final point I want to make is the defense said their opening statement was that it is significant. We did need to pay this right away because the interest is high. It's post-judgment interest, and defense counsel said it's 8 or 9%. I go to PA 6, which is the order for judgment in the case. The interest rate for the 45 days was 2.25%. That's in the record, and it's consistent with the court rule, and it's the order that Judge Wilson signed. It's not 8 or 9%.
That was during the appellate period, but what was the interest going to be if they left it longer?
The interest period.
What was the post-judgment interest going to be if they went beyond the 45 days and didn't pay you?
pay your client?
I don't have that.
Would have probably gone up, I would assume.
I believe the post-judgment and pre-judgment interest amount under 4:42-11 is the same. The rate is the same, whatever the court rules provide for the
You're
rate.
Asking us to consider that interest was accruing.
Correct, at 2.25%, not 8 or 9%. Thank you for the time, Your Honors.
Thank you for the succinct rebuttal. Thank you to all counsel for the arguments.